From the Sunshine State, this is Tampa Bay's TAN Talk.
From Sundress Media Productions, this is Spectrum 360. Welcome. Your Spectrum 360 host is Mark Skogman. Spectrum 360 broadcasts live weekly on Mondays at 11 p.m. and online anytime via podcast. Thank you for listening for the next hour. Spectrum 360 is progressive and features political talk and humor and also the arts and popular culture. Spectrum 360 starts right now. Let's get to work.
Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Any one of you who feels cynical, just consider where we have been.
You want the truth, you should seek it out for yourself. That's what they're afraid of, you.
This is information the world needs to know.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
Thank you. Bless you. This is the end of the meeting. It's the beginning of the movement. Thank you. Yeah.
Hello.
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 Hello. Hello.
Hello. Hello.
Quiet, numbskulls. I'm broadcasting.
That's right, folks. Don't touch that dial.
Spectrum 360. Spectrum 360. Spectrum 360.
From the tropical and beautiful Tampa Bay area in the state of Florida, on the eastern coast of the Gulf of Mexico.
Got the sun on my shoulders and my toes in the sand. Just dreaming, sitting.
This is the radio program Spectrum 360.
You have an incoming transmission.
Welcome. I'm your host, Mark Skogman, on Spectrum 360 in this edition. A rebroadcast of my interview with Robert Groden from Monday, the 25th of November, 2013. This interview is regarding new information about the assassination of former United States President John Fitzgerald Kennedy and Robert's new book, JFK, Absolute Proof. Robert Groden is an expert on the assassination of John Fitzgerald Kennedy. And now, my interview with Robert Groden. We were speaking with Robert Groden about the Kennedy assassination, about his association with the Oliver Stone film JFK, and also about his past books, High Treason, JFK, The Case for Conspiracy, and he has a brand new book out that's only been released about 1 week ago, which is JFK, Absolute Proof. I'm very excited to talk about Robert Groden's new book with him. So that's what we will be doing on this program for the hour. Robert Groden for the hour. One of the pleasures of my life to interview this man. In 1991, it was December 1991, I actually was in the Fort Lauderdale area and decided to go see a film one night. I was working in the area. I got done working, and what did I do? I went to go see a film, and the film I decided to see was JFK, the Oliver Stone film. So I saw the film, and I was stunned by it. I was absolutely stunned by it. It's a fantastic film. After it was completed, the showing of the film, I sat in the theater for about 10 minutes and just could not move. It was hard to believe what I had just seen. And it was very, very interesting, to say the least. That's a gross understatement. So I decided right then and there that I needed to find out for myself what the truth about the Kennedy assassination was. And I had an old college friend who was in the Air Force at the time, who was stationed at Charleston Air Force Base. He was a navigator in C-141 transports. And I was working in that area, and I stopped in to see my old college friend. And I stayed in his guest bedroom one night, and on the bookshelf, I wanted something to read a little bit before I went to sleep. So what I did was I picked up a book off the bookshelf, and the book was High Treason, John F. Kennedy's Murder, Our Government's Betrayal, or excuse me, Our Government's Secret, A Nation's Betrayal, by Robert J. Groden and Harrison Edward Livingstone. That was the book that I chose to read that night. That was also in 1991 or early 1992. And I just absolutely knew after seeing that film and reading just part of this book that I had to become a researcher and find out for myself exactly what happened. So that's what I did. I've been a Kennedy assassination researcher for 22 years now, since 1991 when I saw Oliver Stone's film. And it just piqued my interest to the point where I absolutely just had to do it. So that's my association with the Kennedy assassination and how I became a Kennedy assassination researcher. The film JFK, I must admit, I've seen this film at least 10 times. And the film is 3 hours and 9 minutes long. So that means I've literally spent 30 hours of my life just watching this one film. That's how interesting it is to me. And now we're going to go right to Robert J. Groden. Robert, are you there?
I'm there, Mark. How are you?
Excellent. I'm great because I've been so excited about interviewing you. I've been excited for days just waiting for this, and now it's here. So here we have Robert J. Groden, the author of High Treason, the author of JFK, The Case for a Conspiracy, and also the brand new book out only about a week, JFK, Absolute Proof. And Robert, I'd like to start, just go back to that date, 22 November 1963, and just tell me what happened that day to you. And let's go from there and just progress through how your relationship with the Kennedy assassination happened right from the day that it actually happened in Dallas.
Well, November 22nd, 1963 was my birthday.
Yes, I know that.
Turned 18 years old. And I did a Ferris Bueller type situation. I gave myself the day off. I stayed home from school. And I heard the first reports as they came in over the air. When the president was still considered to be alive, he had his death had not been announced yet, and I remember some of those first broadcasts very, very well, and sat down in front of the TV and just was glued to it, and I had no idea how it would totally control my life, but it has. Started collecting everything I could on that particular issue from the moment it happened. I've always been fascinated by questions of history. This one here I just could not avoid. And that's how it began for me.
Well, very interesting. It's really kind of ironic that JFK was assassinated on your birthday. I mean, that had to have a strong effect on you. I remember, I'm 11 years younger than you are, and I remember myself, the first I heard of it was I walked home from school. I was in elementary school at the time in Anoka, Minnesota. That's the northern suburb of the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. And we got sent home, and I walked home, and I walked into the apartment building where we lived at the time. I got to the front door of my apartment, and my mother came out and said that the president had been assassinated. And that's one of those moments, like just about everyone in the country that's this age. We remember where we were, and there I was sitting in the hallway, and I went back to that exact spot 2 years ago and actually took a photograph of it so I could remember what it was like 50 years ago. Very interesting. Now,
amazing.
Yes, it's very interesting memory to remember right now, to go back to the same spot that was 48 years earlier was where I found out about the Kennedy assassination. I've got a photograph of it. The apartment building still exists. It's right there. It's beautiful, and that was the spot. But anyway, moving on. So The assassination happened on your birthday, and it became a fascination for you. And I really think that what you've told me about the way this developed for you, you felt a responsibility to the president and to the nation to carry out research and go further with this. And then in the 1970s, there was a congressional investigation. How did you get involved with that?
Well, I had worked on the photographic evidence of the Kennedy case on my own for several years. And in 1969, I gained access to the Zapruder film, the actual film of the assassination taken by the dress manufacturer, Abraham Zapruder. And In 1975, Geraldo Rivera learned that I had the film, and he called up and asked if I would be willing to show the film on his TV show, Good Night America. And I thought about it for about, 7 or 8 seconds, and then yeah. I said, yes, I will, sure, okay. How are we going to do it? And, well, we worked it out. You know, we taped the show in advance, but it was a decision which I've never regretted. I brought him the film, and we transferred it at ABC's offices in New York. And in May of that year, I showed the film on national television, and the public outcry was so great that I was invited to Washington, D.C. to present the evidence before Congress, and I showed it at the House of Representatives. And to my absolute amazement, Congressman Thomas Downing of Virginia introduced legislation to reopen the case just 2 days later. Just 2 days. Well, he introduced it 2 days later. It took quite a while for it to pass. But
yes.
He asked me at the time that should it pass, would I be willing to be staff photographic consultant to the committee? And I immediately said yes. So technically, I was the first person hired by the committee. And I held that position until 6 months after the investigation actually ended. So I worked for them for 3 years.
Wow, very interesting. And the broadcast of the Zapruder film on the Geraldo Rivera program, was that the first time that it was broadcast in public? Refresh my memory on that.
That was the very first national showing of the film ever. Some very poor quality copies were shown on college campuses and things of that nature that began with the Jim Garrison investigation in New Orleans. But a clear copy of the film had never been seen by the public. Individual still frames were shown in Life magazine.
Yes, I remember that.
And but nobody really knew what the total effect of the film was, except for a handful of us who had actually seen it. And if you ever get a chance to actually see that original broadcast, what's amazing is the audience response. They've just gasped en masse as one, the entire audience. No one knew what to expect. It had never been seen before. By now, we're all pretty much used to it, and it doesn't have the same effect. It's somewhat plastic because we've seen it so many times. We're used to it, but just imagine having never seen it before, ever. And that was the effect of the film. The film, that showing of the film, first on Good Night America and then in Congress, is what got the case reopened. The case had been dead in the water since 1968 at the end of the Clay Shaw trial in New Orleans.
Now, how exactly did you get your first copy of the Zapruder film? What was the process that happened there?
Well, Life magazine had brought the original film to the company that I worked for, and they wanted to see if it would maintain any kind of resolution, blowing it up from 8mm to 35mm for potential release within a professional documentary.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. And they brought it to us. We had done work on the movie Woodstock, and had blown up 8mm to 35 for that. But nobody had ever tried to do something like this before, because we used intermediate film, 16mm film, in between for Woodstock. But this was direct. No one else had ever gone from 8mm to 35 before.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked beautifully.
Have you ever seen that the digital copy that has been released on... I have a copy of it on VHS video cassette. It was released as part of a program where they did a restoration, where they did an individual photograph of each frame of the Zapruder film and then digitally combined them. Have you ever seen that?
Yes, it's the program is called Image of an Assassination.
Yes, and yes.
It's an examination of the Zapruder film, and what they tried to do digitally was to recreate the system that I had used as an analog technique.
Mm-hmm.
years earlier. I have worked now with the gentleman who was responsible for doing that. His name is Joe Barabee. Very nice guy. Lives in Illinois. And he and I have been discussing doing it again, but this time not using that intermediate step. The intermediate step that they used for that was to make 4x5 transparencies.
Yes, yes, I remember
of
that.
Of every frame of the film. Well, we've been talking about going back to the original film and doing it digitally, just straight through, digitizing from the original film instead of doing the intermediate step, which would make it even clearer, even better. But trying to get permission to do that has not been easy. We have not been successful with that yet.
Because there are some copies of the Zapruder film that were damaged. Some frames were damaged. And there's some interesting, you know, theories about how it was damaged and why. But I know at least one of the copies was damaged, I believe, by a Time Life employee, if I remember right.
That is correct. That's the story we've been told, and it may be true. What happened was the film itself, the original 8mm film, was cut twice during the original process of blowing it up to 4x5 transparency for use in Life magazine. They said that it was, when it was put into a film gate, the film gate was closed over the film and cut it, that it was mishandled. And there's some reason to believe it, and there's another reason not to believe it. For instance, if the frames were cut out, if they were damaged, what happened to them? Where did they disappear to? Where are those original frames?
Exactly.
Which they've never answered. As a matter of fact, when I discovered the first splice and made that known publicly, they denied that it even existed. They freely admitted the second splice as early as 1966, but the first one they still denied up until just a few months, a few weeks ago. A new book has been released called The Day Kennedy Died, and they've revealed every single frame, very small, but every frame of the film, and they've shown both of the areas of that were missing. I think the thing that precipitated that is the fact that in my book, JFK Absolute Proof, I revealed the all those films in book form for the very, very first time. And I think that they got wind that I was going to do that, so now they've done it again.
Now, the Zapruder film, is my understanding, it was developed the day of the assassination itself, which was, of course, 22nd of November, 1963, and that there were at least three copies made that evening, and they were viewed by the Secret Service. Is that correct?
You could not have phrased it more perfectly. I'm saying that because officially there were only three copies made at the Jameson Film Lab in Dallas. The film was originally processed at, and you know, which is a developing process, done at Eastman Kodak in Dallas near Love Field, mm-hmm. in the airport. And officially, there were only three copies made. In fact, I know for a fact there were at least six copies made. One went to a television network news department. One went to a rather rich person in the Dallas area, and the third went to a celebrity who was really fascinated by the Kennedy case. There may have been many, many more, but I have seen two of them and was offered for sale the third one. Additionally, my copies of it, when I enhanced the film, I didn't just show the film by itself. I took the film itself that we had, and I blew it up and I stabilized the film. I re-photographed it frame by frame by frame, repositioning the president so that he is steadied. On the original film, Abraham Zapruder was a man who had vertigo, and he was having trouble maintaining his balance. So the president is essentially all over the screen, sometimes on the left, sometimes on the bottom, sometimes mm-hmm. in the middle. What I did is I blew it up, so I came in and eliminated a lot of the extraneous material around the president himself.
Great.
And I re-photographed it, showing just the president. I did the same thing with Jackie Kennedy. I did the same thing with John Connolly, the governor who was sitting in front of the president. I did it with a driver and Secret Service guard, and several of the important witnesses as well. Needless to say, this whole process with all the versions took a very long period of time, actually over a couple of years.
Well, those are very valuable research tools to have those different versions and stabilized so you can actually see the subjects, you know, in the frame. I would love to see those myself. I think that's very important, very good research material and very important to compare so you can see what happened in the car to each individual person. So that is great. I'm very glad that you did that.
Well, I did that too. I showed these to the House Assassinations Committee, which was created after I released the original films. And we used those as study, which gave us a great deal of insight into what actually did happen at the time of the assassination. But here we are 50 years later, and I'm still discovering new things in the film that we had never seen before. Within the last 2 years, I've discovered two additional shots in the Zapruder film, which we always suspected, but there was never any proof of it.
Really?
Yes. There was an earlier one at frame 142 of the Zapruder film, where a bullet missed the car completely and hit the street. Now, how do you discover something like that? Very simply, a witness by the name of Jean Newman, who was standing there, told me what she had seen and where she saw it. I went back to the original film and I examined it frame by frame by frame until I found, remarkably, the fact that you can see the bullet striking the street in front of a bystander named Philip Willis. On every frame up to 141, there is absolutely nothing in the street. Immediately 142, there's the residue. Of the film, of the bullet striking the asphalt in the street, and it causes a little bit of a flash. And then the frames after it show the residue landing on the ground and staying there.
It doesn't move
after that.
A quick question. Is not the bullet that also caused concrete fragments that cut the cheek of the bystander James Tague by the triple underpass, correct?
Not at all. No, this is a totally different shot than this. Additionally, too, one of the big, most interesting and exciting developments with the House Assassinations Committee is that something which we call the acoustics evidence was developed. And what that was is it was found that there was, in fact, a sound recording made of the shooting itself. And it was recorded by an open microphone on one of the motorcycles, the police motorcycles, near the president's car. Actually, eight car lengths back behind the car, but still in the plaza when the shots took place. And a computer study of these particular sound shots, including the echo patterns, the ultrasonic shock waves, the muzzle blasts, things like that, showed a potential for a great many more shots than the Warren Commission ever agreed to admit. The House Committee arbitrarily eliminated some of these, which were legitimate shots, but were still left with seven shots. They further refined it to the point where it became ridiculous. They were throwing away shots with greater potential to be real shots than some that they allowed.
For in the final analysis, our most basic common link is that we all inhabit this small planet. We all breathe the same air. We all cherish our children's futures. And we are all mortal.
And that was a quote from JFK himself, President John F. Kennedy. That was from the 20th of January, 1961, a speech he gave at American University. I've always loved that quote, and I wanted to play it tonight just to give us a flavor of what President Kennedy was thinking when he took office as president. This is Mark Skogman, host of Spectrum 360 on the TAN Talk Radio Network. Spectrum 360 is a political talk radio program that features politics, the arts, and popular culture from a progressive point of view. Spectrum 360 broadcasts for 1 hour weekly on Monday nights at 11 p.m. Eastern Time and anytime via podcast at TANTalk1340.com. Remember, Spectrum 360, politics from a progressive point of view.
We take care of our own.
Climate change is changing our world in more ways than you may think. Because it's not just climate that's changing. People are changing the way they live their lives and the way they see the world. And these changes are the beginning of something huge. It's good, because we need to act now before the next big storm hits to strengthen and restore the natural defense system that protects us all from high water and winds. The climate is changing, but so are we. Learn what you can do.
Spectrum 360. Spectrum 360.
This is Spectrum 360. This is your host, Mark Skogman, and we're interviewing Robert J. Groden, the author of JFK, Absolute Proof. And now we're going to go back to Robert Groden. More interesting discussion about the Zapruder film. Robert, let's take up right where we left off. We were just discussing James Tague and the evidence in the that you've been able to get from the Zapruder film of additional bullets. Let's take it from there.
Right. Okay. One of the things, as I was saying just before the break, was that the discovery that the sounds were recorded was one of the most exciting things that the House Committee developed. And what they had found was that the fatal headshot was an impulse at frame 312, 313 of the Zapruder film, fired at 312, hitting at 313. But they had discovered an additional shot 0.7 of a second later. That's about 0.75 of a second after the fatal headshot.
So after the fatal headshot.
After the fatal headshot. I went to the film, and I counted off the number of frames, because the Zapruder film is a clock for the assassination.
Yes.
Each frame is 0.18 of a frame before or after the frame next to it. So when I got to that point at 327, frame 327, 328, 329, in that area, you actually can see a second bullet striking the president in the head. The one at 313 came from the front and blew out the back of his head. But the other one, the one at 327, came from behind, hit the back of his head, and started to blow out bits of brain and blood at a very immediate rate. And the president, when he's hit at 313, is pushed rearward against the seat. If you remember the movie JFK,
yes,
there's that line, back and to the left.
Yes.
Back and to the left. Well, after he goes back and to the left, he bounces off the seat and starts heading forward. At 327, 328, in that area, his acceleration forward increases noticeably. And at that point, just brain matter just starts spewing out the front of his head, and you notice it against the black collar of Mrs. Kennedy's suit that she's wearing. She's wearing a pink suit with a black collar.
Yes.
And if you look at that right by the president's head, you see this massive amount of blood and brain, which the reason why that's so important is here we have a second headshot within 1 second. Now, to fire that gun twice takes a minimum of 2.3 seconds. So this had to come from another point, plus the fact that it's from a different direction. So this, more than anything else, is actual physical scientific proof that there was, in fact, a second shooter.
Wow, that's very interesting. I did hear a little bit of information about that very recently, and I was just wondering what you would say about that, and you've actually confirmed that. So, I mean, that is, I guess we could use the phrase accurately, absolute proof that Lee Harvey Oswald was definitely not the only shooter, if you even believe he shot any shots at all. He definitely couldn't have shot these two shots at the same time. And that's always been a problem for me as well, because my understanding is from the eyewitness testimony, or maybe more accurately, the ear witness testimony, is that the second and third shots after the shooting started were almost simultaneous, and they couldn't have come from the so-called Oswald rifle either.
Well, you're completely and absolutely correct. Your observation there could not be more perfect. The witnesses said it was like bang, bang for those last two shots. And that's exactly what happened. The witnesses in the plaza were correct. And those who said that that the shot that they felt hit the president in the head came from the front, they were correct, too. What's so important was that the acoustics evidence and what we see in the Zapruder film match exactly to the microsecond. And this to me is extremely exciting. I go into a great deal of detail about this in the new book.
Yes.
And there's a lot of other interesting stuff too in the book. That's just one of them. But since you had brought up about multiple shooters and James Tague being hit on the cheek, that kind of fit that moment.
Yes. Now, there was also a bullet that actually hit the chrome on the inside of the front windshield as well, correct?
That is correct. One hit the inside of the chrome at the windshield. One either a full bullet or a fragment of a bullet hit the windshield itself. There was a spot across the street on Elm Street on the south side by a manhole cover that was hit by a bullet. Another one hit the sidewalk on the north side of Elm Street. And the one that you pointed out before hit the south curb of Main Street and hit James Tague on the cheek toward the end of the shooting. Now, one of the crazy TV documentaries, which I call mockumentaries.
Yes, good term.
Well, within the last year, stated that an early bullet must have struck the street lamp and ricocheted off to hit James Tague. Well, if it had hit from behind and ricocheted off, it would have gone backwards, heading back toward the east. James Tague was as far to the west as you can get in the plaza. James Tague himself was interviewed by the people who produced that thing, and he told them that he was hit at the end of the shooting, not at the beginning. So they didn't use his interview because it killed their theory.
Well, also, there was a bullet strike on the sidewalk, and some evidence that I've read indicates that the FBI or someone working with the FBI actually removed a section of the curb that had a bullet strike on it to destroy evidence. Do you have any information about that?
It's the same one that we're talking about. Well, actually, it's two. There were two that were removed. One hit the...
Two?
Yeah, one hit.
I only know about one.
Well, there were two. The one that you mentioned initially was the James Tague hit, which hit on the curb by a very narrow piece of sidewalk.
Yes.
About 15 feet from where Jim Tague was standing. And in June or so, I believe it was June of 1964, the FBI came down there with jackhammers and they removed 15 feet of the curbing and got it out of the plaza. But another bullet hit on the sidewalk, the north sidewalk of Elm Street. And when I found that bullet hit and started talking about it, the FBI came down and removed that one, too. And they put in a round circular plug about 4 inches in diameter to hide it.
That's crazy. What conceivable reason would you have for removing 15 feet of sidewalk at a murder scene? That smacks of evidence tampering or evidence suppression to me. And I know there's a lot of good people in the FBI, but you know, there are so many cases where the FBI appears to destroy evidence as well. And I just have to say that this is a pattern that I've seen with the FBI investigating other cases as well, as they seem to suppress evidence as well as collect it.
Well, the Secret Service did that too. They started to mop out the president's car, the Lincoln limousine. With a bucket and a mop at the hospital. That was the crime scene, for crying out loud.
Exactly.
And they got rid of it. They got rid of the bullet fragments. There were bullet fragments removed from Governor Connally's wrist, a whole bunch of them that have disappeared. A bullet was removed from President Kennedy during the autopsy. It's signed for. We have two FBI agents who signed for this bullet. Siebert and O'Neill were the names of the agents. We've got the receipt, but we've never seen the bullet. The bullet that was removed from Lee Harvey Oswald when 2 days later when he was being operated on after Jack Ruby shot him, we've never seen that bullet. That bullet has never appeared anywhere. And that was evidence at the Ruby trial, we were told, but it was never presented.
Crazy.
But let me go into one more thing about the bullet since we're on the subject.
Mm-hmm.
There is an exhibit, a Warren Commission exhibit, called CE-399. That is the so-called magic bullet, the bullet that was recovered, we're told, in Parkland Hospital very soon after the assassination. Now, this is the bullet that the Warren Commission told us caused all the non-fatal damage to both President Kennedy and Governor Connally. 7 separate wounds in 2 grown men, 1 bullet. That bullet was on Air Force One when the plane took off for Washington, D.C. However, 3 hours later, there is a press conference held in Parkland Hospital where Dr. Robert Shaw is asked by a reporter about the bullet in Governor Connally's leg. And he says, and it's almost a direct quote, "The bullet is still in his leg. It is not life-threatening and will be removed once the governor stabilizes." So here we've got the same bullet on Air Force One on its way back to Washington and still in Governor Connally's leg.
Well, yeah,
that's amazing to me.
That whole story, I mean, this the so-called, the single bullet theory from the Warren Commission that has been derisively called the magic bullet theory because it's so ridiculous. I'm insulted that the government would expect me to believe such a ridiculous theory. Here you have, one bullet that supposedly causes 7 wounds and apparently pauses in midair, comes in from different angles, and then is found on a stretcher in Parkland Hospital in unfired condition. I mean, any 16-year-old that has shot a gun knows that that is ludicrous. I mean, it insults my intelligence to think that the government expects me to believe such a ludicrous, absolutely stupid theory that just defies common sense. I mean, anybody who's handled any kind of firearms knows that that can't possibly be true.
Well, the man who invented the theory was Arlen Specter.
Yes.
Became a senator from Philadelphia. I'm sorry, from Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
But the man who actually sold it to the Warren Commission and to the public was Gerald Ford.
Yes. That's correct.
Need I say more?
Yes, and he stuck to that story until his death.
That's true, but just before he died, he was asked about this, about the single bullet and the fact that the angles are all wrong and the timing is all wrong. It could never work. But he said, he admitted finally toward the end that he had arbitrarily moved verbally the location of the wound in the president's back from his back to the back of his neck to allow the downward angle. Again, nobody in the press seems to care about that. But now, how do you clarify something by altering it and changing it? It made no sense at all.
Yes, very interesting. I didn't know that he made any kind of admissions like that, even close to the end of his life. To my knowledge, he died holding to the same story, which is the official story. Some of my research has indicated that Gerald Ford's being a member of the Warren Commission, he was representing the CIA's interest on the Warren Commission.
Actually, you're close on that one. It's the FBI. He was the one who was informing to the FBI in violation of his secrecy oath. The man who was doing what you said for the CIA was actually Alan Dulles, the former director of the CIA. But you have the right idea for sure. Absolutely.
Yes, Alan Dulles, his life history is very interesting. I've been reading another book that has a lot of information about Alan Dulles. It's not related to the Kennedy assassination, called Gray Wolf, which goes through the history of the Secret Service and the OSS during World War II. And it's very interesting background information on how Alan Dulles became involved in the CIA and then became involved in the Kennedy assassination and in the Warren Commission. Very, very interesting man. This is Mark Skogman, host of Spectrum 360 and the TAN Talk Radio Network. Spectrum 360 is a political talk radio program that features politics, the arts, and popular culture from a progressive point of view. Spectrum 360 broadcasts for 1 hour weekly on Monday nights at 11 p.m. Eastern Time and anytime via podcast at tantalk1340.com. Remember, Spectrum 360, politics from a progressive point of view.
We take care of our own, wherever this flag's flown.
This is Spectrum 360. This is your host, Mark Skogman, and we're interviewing Robert J. Groden, the author of JFK, Absolute Proof. Take us through the sequence of the bullets now. With all this additional evidence, what is the sequence of the bullets, and how many shots actually were there?
Wow, that is one of the more interesting and difficult questions to try to answer.
Yes, I know. Sorry.
Well, the reason why is this. On the afternoon of the assassination, initially and in the initial reports of both the FBI and the Dallas Police Department, there were only two. In JFK Absolute Proof, I show the photographs taken by the Dallas Police and by the FBI and the reports of both agencies showing that there were only two bullet shells found.
Mm-hmm.
They came back on Monday, re-photographed the area, threw down a third bullet to make it look as if there had been more because two bullets could not account for all the shooting within that period of time. Now, that's two shots. Then it became officially three for the Warren Commission, and they left it at that. But the House Assassinations Committee, when I worked for them, we had proof of seven shots, but that was too far away from the Warren Commission's three. So they arbitrarily eliminated two of those shots and made it, I'm sorry, three of those shots and made it four. They said in their final report, they say at least four shots were fired. So that since we have shots from two different angles, front and rear, and too many shots fired within the time frame, it means at least a second shooter. But there were other shots fired from multiple directions that show that there was actually at least three or four people shooting, most probably four, and possibly as many as six. But if you go by the actual sound recordings, the sounds on the police tape, the actual sound recordings done by the Dallas Police Department, there were possibly as many as 15 shots fired, including all the ones that missed.
Do you believe at all in this theory that LBJ's hatchet man, Malcolm Wallace, was on the sixth floor shooting?
I tend to believe it because his fingerprint was found up there.
Yes.
And this is so. Malcolm Wallace, who worked for Lyndon Johnson from 1953 on until 1 week before Johnson himself died, in all that period of time, he's been linked to or hope. Maybe linked is too strong a word. Maybe it's not. He has been mentioned in 18 separate murders, all for Johnson, except for one.
Well, my understanding is that there was a Texas grand jury convened. I believe it was sometime in the 70s, and that the Johnson associate, Billy Saul Estes, indicated that President Johnson himself was implicated in 11 murders, one of them which was his own sister, Josepha Johnson.
You're absolutely correct, yes. Johnson would have ordered it. Johnson would have been part of it. But the man who actually would have done the murders was, in fact, as you pointed out, Malcolm Wallace. Wallace was also involved and absolutely guilty as hell in the murder of a man named Henry Marshall.
Yes.
And Henry Marshall was an agricultural secretary who was investigating Lyndon Johnson, Billy Saul Estes, and Bobby Baker, that whole crew.
Mm-hmm.
And they couldn't buy him off, so they killed him.
Exactly.
He was shot five times with a single-shot rifle, and Johnson had declared suicide.
Exactly, and it's quite obviously not a suicide. Something else I want to touch on as well, the whereabouts of Lee Harvey Oswald in the book depository as the Kennedy assassination was happening. Now, my research indicates that he was in the second floor lunchroom, that he was not winded from a run down the stairs from the sixth floor, and he was sitting there drinking a Coke, and he was identified by his supervisor and a Dallas police officer that ran into the building right after the assassination. Is that what your research indicates?
Well, yes, but there is there's a footnote to that. Lee Oswald had been in the snack room up until about a minute before the shooting. He then walked across the hallway to get change for the Coca-Cola machine. The machine itself, back in those days, they didn't make change for dollars, and he needed change to buy his Coke.
Mm-hmm.
And he went across into the office and asked a lady named Geraldine Reed to make change for a dollar. And he said he didn't want any pennies. He just wanted nickels, dimes, and quarters. I guess they thought it was backfires or firecrackers or something. And she continues to count out the dollars worth of change. Lee goes across the hallway into the snack room, buys the Coke, and that's when he is seen by Dallas police officer Marion Baker and his boss, Roy Truly. This was a total of 72 seconds after the fatal headshot.
So there's an absolute confirmation that Lee Harvey Oswald wasn't even on the sixth floor and absolutely could not be the shooter.
There you go. It wasn't just her. She wasn't the only one who saw Lee there. There were others who saw him there, too.
And then there were two women that were on the stairs, and if he had run down from the sixth floor to the second floor, number one, he would have been winded. Number two, the two witnesses on the stairs that testified that they never saw him, he would have had to go by them, and they absolutely testified that he did not.
That's correct. Their names were Victoria Adams and Sandra Style.
So we know, really, that Lee Harvey Oswald wasn't the shooter, that there are multiple shooters and that there were multiple shots, and now, after all these years, we know that there was almost simultaneously two headshots. I was just very shocked when I first heard that, and it's just sickening to think of what happened to this man's head.
Well, you know, you asked a question a few minutes ago, which is a very profound question. That question is, how could they think they were going to get away with this? Well, very simply, the way they got away with it was by hiding the evidence. You weren't allowed to see it. Nobody was allowed to see the evidence. The Zapruder film was withheld from public view until I released it in 1975. The autopsy photographs were hidden from public view until I released them. By the way, they are in the new book. They're in Absolute Proof.
Great. I've got another question to ask you as well.
Sure.
There was a Geraldo Rivera program that you were on with Madeline Brown. Was that the same one that you were speaking about previously?
No, that was a different one altogether. I was actually on Goodnight America, actually several Geraldo Rivera shows. I think I was on four or five of them through the years. Well, back when Geraldo was being honest about all of this, now he is sold out to the other side and refuses to admit that he was right back at the beginning.
Yeah, interesting, because I remember the video of that program that I saw, and I don't remember which exact one that was. Madeline Brown states that she had met Lyndon Johnson the evening before. This was the Thursday night before the Friday that Kennedy was killed, and that there was a meeting where Lyndon Johnson was there, J. Edgar Hoover, Richard Nixon, and a number of other people. And then after the meeting broke up, he went by Madeline Brown, his mistress, and said, after tomorrow, the blankety-blank Kennedys will never embarrass me again. That's not a threat. That's a promise. Is that your understanding? And she said that on that Geraldo Rivera program. I've always wondered what your opinion was of that.
Well, absolutely. She had told me that about 5 years before that Geraldo Rivera show. She's always told that. She stuck to that story. But she refused to go public while she and Lyndon's son, they had a son together named Stephen,
mm-hmm.
while he was alive, she would not go public with it. And when Johnson was alive, but she did go public afterward, and she wrote a book called Texas in the Morning, where she actually went public with this in print.
Interesting. One other thing I absolutely have to ask you about is there's this book by Vincent Bugliosi, who was the prosecutor of the Charles Manson case in the 60s. Where he sticks to the official story. And I saw just briefly Saturday night, I saw just a few minutes of CNN where they were interviewing him on the program. And that's all I saw. So I don't know what else was in that program because I only saw just a few minutes of it. But he was sticking to the official story. And I can't believe that a man as intelligent as Vincent Bugliosi actually published a book like that and actually thinks that the official story is actually true. How could that be?
Well, I don't think he really thinks it. I think that's what he states. But he, as you said, you know, he can't be stupid enough to actually believe that. What happened was this. During the Manson trial, he had a moment of fame where he did something that was really, really brave and really, really good, even though the investigation in the case was actually done by the LAPD. It was done by the police department. He just prosecuted him. He didn't develop the case. But that was his moment of fame. So now, all these years later, there's a trial done for television in England called On Trial Lee Harvey Oswald. Jerry Spence was the defense attorney, and Vincent Bugliosi was the prosecuting attorney. So when he got the opportunity to write another book, one on the Kennedy assassination, he couldn't change sides. So what he did is he picked the Warren Commission as a client. Now, he's an attorney. He picks the Warren Commission as a client, and he defends them. That's what he did. He didn't care about the truth. He still doesn't care about the truth. He's got the rifle found in the wrong end of the building. He's got Oswald standing at the window, firing out of the window. When, if you've ever been up there, you know you'd have to be down on your knees to fire through that open window.
Yes, exactly.
It's only 60. The windowsill is only about 16 inches off the ground. So yeah, he knows nothing about it. He didn't really write the book. He wasn't even really there. And we have one lie after another. And the thing is, he's not alone. You know, the powers that be have brought out so many people like Hugh Ainsworth and other people backing the lies of the Warren Commission that, you know, you have to wonder why so many people are going to such lengths 50 years later and they won't even face the actual evidence. They will not. None of these people will ever mention the fact that 88 medical people who viewed the president's head said that the shot came from the front. 88.
Wow.
By the way, I have the statements of all 88 in absolute proof.
Oh, that's great. Well, I think we can summarize everything that we've discussed here tonight by saying that we've absolutely been lied to about the Kennedy assassination. That the Kennedy assassination was a form of coup d'etat. He was killed not by Lee Harvey Oswald, but a conspiracy of multiple shooters. And that means that the officials, you know, the supposed magic bullet theory is absolutely false. And I think you've absolutely nailed it. The new book by Robert Groden is JFK Absolute Proof. I am looking forward very much to getting a copy and reading it and seeing it myself. I wish we had a 3-hour program to discuss this topic, because that's about how many questions I still have ready for Robert Groden. But we're coming to the end of the program here in about 1 minute. So, Robert, do you have any closing thoughts?
Well, if anyone's interested in the book or seeing it, please just wait a few days. There will be a website up from conspiracypublications.com, which will show you how to get the book. I really appreciate the opportunity to be on your show, Mark, because it's you're very, very well aware of this. I wish there were more, and unfortunately there aren't.
Well, Robert, I've said this to you in person before. I think you're a national hero. I think you've done fantastic work, and it's definitive, and you've done a tremendous service to the nation and the truth, and I really thank you for that.
Well, I thank you.
All right, it's Robert Groden. Remember the new book, JFK, Absolute Proof. Get a copy right away. This is hot stuff, very important reading. The Kennedy assassination is a very important part of American history. This is Spectrum 360. We'll be back next week with another Spectrum 360 radio program.
Spectrum 360 is produced by Sunburst Media Productions and originates from St. Petersburg, Florida. Executive producer, host, audio engineer, and senior reporter, Mark Skogman. Associate producer, Terry Weeks. Spectrum 360 broadcasts live weekly on Mondays at 11 p.m. for 1 hour and online anytime via podcast. To access the podcast, go to www.facebook.com/Spectrum360 Radio Program and click on the program link. Thank you to all our listeners and supporters and the staff of Spectrum 360. Listen next week for another interesting, informative, and entertaining Spectrum 360 radio program.
That's all, folks.